Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Hello, 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 one and all, and a very warm welcome to Series 9 of Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. It feels great to be back, and I've missed you. I have. How are you? I mean, you look great. Is that a new haircut? Yeah, I thought so. Really suits you. Yes, it's me, Joe Haddow, and whether you're a brand new listener to the podcast or one of our old friends, it's great to have you with us, and what a series we have lined up for you coming up over the next few weeks. We'll be joined and hearing from best-selling American novelist David Baldacci, international best-selling superstar Marianne Keyes, former pop star, vicar, broadcaster and writer Reverend Richard Coles, international best-selling author and columnist Linwood Barclay, Booker Prize-winning author Damon Gamut, and actress, singer, presenter and a childhood hero of mine, Baroness Floella Benjamin as well, just to name a few. But enough of the future, let's focus on the here and now, and I'm thrilled to be joined for episode one of Series 9 by two fabulous authors, both of whom are warming up in the wings, ready to go head-to-head in a battle of the books a little later on. My first guest is a best-selling writer whose work has been translated into 26 languages and who has been nominated for the George Orwell Prize and the Commonwealth Writers' Prize, to name just two. She is a fellow of the Royal Society of Literature and the author of 5 books, including the Booker Prize shortlisted novel Brick Lane, which was turned into a feature film, you may remember, way back in 2007. Can it be that long ago? Here to tell us about her latest novel, Love Marriage, it's Monica Alley. Welcome to Book Off, Monica.
Hi.
Thank you so much for joining. It's lovely to see you. And my second guest is a writer and dispute resolution lawyer who won the inaugural Murky Books New Writers Prize back in 2019. She studied law at Cambridge and holds a master's degree from the University of Oxford. In short, she's far too intelligent to be on this podcast, but she's here and here to tell us about her debut novel, We Are All Birds of Uganda. It's Hafsa Zayan. Welcome to you, Hafsa.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. It's such a privilege and an honour to be with Monica.
I thought you were going to say it's a privilege and honour to be with me. I was thinking,
and
no,
you got that,
you got that wrong.
I did wonder how you were going to follow your introduction of Monica with mine, but hey ho, you did a good job.
Now, I've got some really strong coffee on the go. Monica, I know, is on decaf, and are you just going without? Are you?
I'm just on water.
You're so healthy and so good and putting us all to shame. And I should introduce you both, Hafsa, Monica, Hafsa, because, of course, we are virtual. And I doubt you've met before, have you?
No, we haven't. No, I'm delighted to meet you, Hafsa.
Thank you so much. No, I obviously know who you are quite well. You probably don't know who I am, but I've had sort of...
Do you now.
Brick Lane was on my mother's shelf, because I read a lot of my mother's books when I was younger, but Brick Lane was on my mother's shelf for years. I mean, it's one of the standout books that I remember in her sort of little library at home. So it was one of like the first, really one of like the first books I even remember reading.
I feel wow. So ancient now.
But can you imagine how honoured I feel?
We got ancient and we got honoured. And you're both being so lovely and polite. I'm just wondering how that's going to change later in the book off when you're going.
Got to keep them sweet.
So over the next 30 minutes or so, we're going to discuss both of your new novels, as I mentioned. We'd love to hear about your writing and what you're, what you've been reading and enjoying recently. And the book off will come at the end. This is where you'll each pitch us a book that you absolutely love and you think that we should all read. But first, Monica, if I could talk about Love Marriage, which is the title of your new novel, and a wonderful novel it is. And this is the title is The Planned Wedding Between Yasmin and Joe. Perhaps you could tell us a little bit about them, set up their families for us, and the story.
I'll give it a go. So Yasmin Gharami is 26 years old. She's a junior doctor at a big London hospital, engaged to be married to Joe, who is a fellow doctor. He's charming, he's handsome, he's rich, he's kind, everything that you could possibly want. And then he goes and does the unthinkable. He cheats on her. And Yasmin goes off and has revenge sex, much against her better judgment, because she's always been such a good girl. And so she's tortured by the fact that she's, you know, gone against her principles and her morals. And unlike Joe, she doesn't confess to her infidelity. So she's tortured by it. But little does she know that Joe is in therapy for his sex addiction. So so we start off with Yasmin sort of having quite a carefully planned, a controlled life plan. She knows what she wants, she knows where she's going, and then everything starts to implode and explode.
Yeah, because at the beginning of the novel, you know, we get a real sense of these two families, and we certainly get a sense of her family life, I think. Yasmin's family life, because of, you know, still living with her parents, and Joe lives with his mum. And it's sort of, you know, you lull us in, and then it just, it sort of upturns. And we're, as readers, we're sort of left going, oh, hang on, because we know the life plan, and we sort of feel like they're both, you know, that we don't see any issues in those early pages, I think. How important was it to establish both of those families to you, and where did those characters come from?
Yeah, so they're from very different backgrounds. So I wouldn't say there are no concerns at the beginning. The concerns are Yasmin's anxieties around the two families meeting for the first time. So the opening sentence is, in the Gharami household, sex was never mentioned. And then we learn very quickly that Joe's mother is a famous feminist writer, famed for a memoir about all her lovers, male and female, that there's an infamous photograph of her that was taken as a feminist statement, very explicit photograph. Her little brother's winding her up about it. And they're going off for this dinner at Joe's mother's house in Primrose Hill, which is very posh. And Yasmin's from a solid sort of middle class, but ordinary background. Her father's a GP. So there's all the cultural differences and anxieties. There's the social and class anxieties. And then there's just the, you know, the bride thing, you know, the bridezilla thing. Like, is it all going to be okay? And it does go wrong, but not in the ways that she imagines. There's no clash of cultures. I mean, you know, I think people have been describing it, or some people at least, as a book about a clash of cultures. And to my mind, it is not that at all. There's anxieties around the culture. But in fact, Harriet, who's Joe's mother, embraces the Gharamis. I mean, far too much for Yasmin's liking.
Yeah, she does. And also, I just loved that quite near the beginning, and it's on the way to that family dinner where they end up setting off so early, you know, and there's this sort of, oh my God, we're going to turn up an hour early, and it's and just little things like that I loved about the sort of family dynamics and things that we could all relate to.
And Anissa, Yasmin's mother, taking the dinner with her.
All the food.
All day. She's got all these Tupperware boxes and tins. And to her mind, she's being a brilliant guest. And to Yasmin's mum, she is just being hugely embarrassing. But Harriet actually abandons the lasagna and she, you know, she eats the curries with relish and she loves it.
Yeah. I mean, Anissa is just such a scene-stealing character. Where did she come from? Is she based on anyone or is she a complete fabrication from your imagination?
I could never divulge these things. I will go to my grave without revealing my sources. I'm always stealing bits of people, but never an entire person. So
okay.
just the body parts, not the entire body.
I like that. Yeah, fine. That's a great answer. And Hafsa, We Are All Birds of Uganda is a book that we've talked about a lot before, and we have met, and it was on the Radio 2 Book Club. It's done incredibly well. You must be so proud. And there will be people listening who've read this book and are awaiting your next novel. But for those who haven't, perhaps you could just set up the story of Samir and Hassan for us and just give us a little taste of this book.
Of course. So you've already mentioned the sort of two protagonists, Samir. It's a dual narrative. So Samir's story is set in modern day Britain. He's the son of Ugandan Asian immigrants. They came over to this country in 72 after Idi Amin expelled South Asians from Uganda. And so he's grown up in this country. He's a high-flying sort of city lawyer, lives smack bang in the middle of the city, earns loads of money, goes on nights out, has a great time. But he's kind of feeling a bit empty and lost. And he essentially, his story sort of details his journey of kind of self-realization and discovery about who he is and a bit more about his background. Now, set against this is the historic narrative, which is narrated by Hassan. The novel opens with Hassan's chapters in the form of letters to his deceased wife, who's the love of his life, and he's getting married to somebody else through family pressure, someone who's actually a sort of distant family member. He's marrying their wife because that person died. The story starts with Hassan's story in 1945, so just after the Second World War, and he basically is talking about his experiences as a South Asian living in Uganda shortly before the British leave, and then after the British leave, and all the way up until 72, following kind of the nationalisation policies and the expulsion, and kind of where Hassan ends up, which is ultimately, pretty obviously, the UK.
The UK, yeah. And these two timelines, as you've said, is how you tell this story. And I wondered if you thought that the concept of duty and cultural expectation has changed from Hassan's generation to Samir's.
Yeah, I don't. There are certainly cultural expectations and duties that are placed upon both of these protagonists. Their forms might have changed, but the fact that these duties and expectations exist continues. It's an interesting exploration to see how far down the generations they'll continue, because Samir is, of course, a second generation immigrant. So his parents were born in another country and then migrated here. But for Samir's children, for example, they'll be born in the same country that he was born in, potentially. And so there's a question of to what extent those kind of, you know, those ties continue to bind you, those duties continue to hold you down. Like, you know, even in my life, I was born in the UK, my parents are immigrants, I now have a daughter, and I just wonder to what extent I'm going to place cultural expectations and familial duties on her, because I want to I think of myself as quite progressive and modern and liberal, and, you know, but then I also think, well, I never want, you know, now that she's been born, I never want her living away from home. Yeah. I just suddenly have these thoughts. Yeah. And then I think to myself, oh my God, who have I become? It's a really interesting.
How old is your daughter, Hafsa?
She's 9 months old. So I'm actually still on maternity leave. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, you see, when they get to the age of my children, then you'd be desperate for them to leave home.
Yeah. I can imagine. I do keep thinking to myself, she's so lovely and perfect now. What's going to happen when she starts talking back?
Yeah.
Will I still love her? I just don't know.
And I imagine the book took quite a while to write. I feel like, you know, it was brewing for a long time, and it was, you know, based on some of your experiences, Hafsa. And since the success and the Murky Books award that I mentioned, there must be a little bit of pressure for whatever the next one is. Have you found that you're able to, you know, is it easier to write this next one, or is it proving harder?
Well, I should start out by saying the next one, as of yet, does not exist.
Doesn't exist. I'd say,
no. So I'm still working full time as a lawyer, other than the fact I'm on maternity leave. And before I had this baby, I did think to myself, I'll write the second novel on maternity leave, definitely,
yes, <sir. laughs>
because I have an idea. I have an idea, and so I you know, I've made a few notes on it. I kind of know where the plot's going to go. I know kind of what I want to write about, and I thought, I'll just do that in maternity leave. And of course, literally nothing has been done. Now, she is going to nursery next month before I go back to work. And so I think I will finally get the time to actually sit down and write something when she's not on my hands anymore. But yeah, I mean, it's been interesting, because obviously I still have this kind of this day job, but it's not really a day job. It's more like a day and night job, because that's kind of what being a lawyer is like. It's like it's a 24/7 kind of job. Squeezing writing in the gaps is quite a discipline. You have to be very disciplined, and you have to be very focused and also very motivated. And the thing with the Murky Books Prize is that I had a legal obligation to write the book, because I'd signed a contract saying I was going to write it. So I forced myself to write. With this next one, it's just kind
of
like...
As a lawyer, you knew you had to come through on that as well, right?
Exactly. With this next one, it's just like, could take me like 7 years. I don't know. We'll see. The great thing is I'm still writing lots of little bits and pieces, you know, short stories for magazines, and, you know, I did an essay in a collection and things like that. So there are little things that are still coming out of me. I haven't stopped writing altogether. Hopefully the bigger piece is not going to be that far away.
I didn't mean to put any sort of pressure on you there. That was, you know, it came from a place of, you know, we really want the next one. That's all. That's all.
Well, that's very much appreciated. Thank you.
Do you remember, Monica, writing your earlier books and how that was for you? Were you juggling other work and motherhood and things as well?
Well, when I wrote Brick Lane, when I started it, I had a 2-year-old and a little baby and very little childcare. So I know exactly what you're talking about.
Kudos. This is even more impressive now.
But you were looking back. People would ask at that time, or, you know, after the book came out, you know, how did you manage that? And I would say, it was fine. I wrote when they were napping or in the night, and so on. But looking back, I just think, oh my God, I was in such denial. It was exhausting. And I think I felt like I wasn't allowed to complain. And there's that Cyril Connolly quote, I think it's him, about the pram in the hallway being the enemy of promise. And I think I was so determined to prove that wrong that I just was driven. But it, you know, at a price, at a cost. And I would highly recommend waiting you don't have to do it when they're napping.
I have to say, though, I do feel like generally what I've experienced in my motherhood so far is that when you need to do something, you find you can do it. You think you can't do it, and then you have no choice, and you are able to do it. And I guess for you, maybe, you know, Brick Lane, there was a real need there. There was a need to get this story out. There was a need for you, as you said, you were very driven to prove them wrong, so to speak. So I do think that's true.
And my grandfather had just died, my mother's father, and I've been, you know, thinking about writing this novel for some time, and the day after the funeral is the day that I sat down to start writing. And I think there's something quite galvanizing about a funeral. It's just, you know, if there's something that you want to do with this life, you only have so many days, you only have so many years, and you've got to just get on with it. So my husband very kindly took the kids away for a couple of hours, and I sat down and started what became Brick Lane.
Wow. And I read recently a book that my dad gave me. I think it's called 4,000 Weeks, quite a new book that's just come out. And it sort of sat, initially I thought, oh goodness, it's going to be one of those books that sort of goes, you're running out of time, what are you doing with your life? You know, blah, blah. Actually, it's really good because it sort of just breaks it all down a bit and just goes, you know, hey, it's all good. You got to do this and you got to do a bit of that. We've got to work. But it does make you really think, you know, just thinking about your grandfather's funeral and that, reading this book, I was like, 4,000 weeks ain't that much, is it? You know, when you break it down.
And I'm going to buy that. Who is it by?
It's by Oliver Berkman. It's called 4,000 Weeks. It's really great. And I think anyone would sort of get something from this book, actually. And it isn't the sort of depressing, oh, life is running away from us. It's not that. It's much sort of cleverer than that. And it looks at how we spend our time in a really interesting way. So there you go. That's my little book tip for you. And what you're talking about, Brick Lane there, Monica, mentioned that, which, as I said, was adapted into a film. And I believe you're now adapting Love Marriage as well for the BBC. Is that right?
Yes, I'm working with a production company called New Pictures, who are brilliant. And it was really exciting because there was an auction for the screen rights. And it was just thrilling because I had tried during my long fallow period to write some screenplays for TV drama, basically because I was watching a lot of telly, and I thought, maybe I can do that. Nothing ever got made, but I so enjoyed working collaboratively with different production companies, and I so enjoyed the challenge of learning something new. And now that I'm working on the adaptation for Love Marriage, it's really nice because all of those skills that I learned, all those craft skills, are now coming back into use. And also I get more time to spend with Yasmin and Joe. And TV is very, very story hungry. I mean, there is an awful lot of story in this book, but there are scenes that I deleted from the book that I can now, you know, I can start playing with again, or things great that happen off stage that I can now, you know, perhaps put on stage, you know, backstory and things like that. So, yeah, I'm loving it.
And it has been a long time coming, this book, or certainly since we had a Monica Ali book. And has that just been that you wanted to explore those other avenues, or you just didn't have the story you wanted to write, or you just thought, oh, I'm just going to have a few years off?
Laziness. I was just running around for 10 years. it's been 10 years since my last book was out. And I have spoken about this a bit recently, but I was just, I lost confidence and I stopped writing. I mean, I think it's very good for writers to have self-doubt because you want to make sure that every sentence is as good as it can be. But you also have to have a core of self-belief. Otherwise, you'd never think it was worth doing. But I lost all confidence, and then I stopped. So I stopped writing, and when I wasn't writing, I got depressed, and being depressed, you lose even more confidence. So I was kind of in this sort of downward spiral for a few years. And then actually the screenwriting, or trying to learn the craft of screenwriting, actually oddly helped me to get back into writing fiction, because it just sparked that joy of writing. I mean, there's a torture of writing, but there's also a joy of writing. And yeah, it just helped me get back in the saddle, I think. It made me realise that I do need to be writing.
Oh, that's great. And what a great way to sort of get find it again and to come back and get the confidence. And of course, screenwriting is so different to writing a novel, isn't it? You know, there are lots you can draw on from writing prose, but actually you have to almost relearn and throw all those things you were told or that you've learned about writing novels out the window and go, no, it's this now, isn't it? It's about sharper dialogue and we're not going into these long sort of descriptions anymore.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I always enjoy writing dialogue. That's one of the things that I enjoy most in writing fiction. But yeah, you're quite right. It's not just a series of conversations on the page. There's much more to it than that, and structurally it's a big challenge, but I've enjoyed working with New Pictures again on how to structure it, and you have to move some things around that happen later in the book that you need to see earlier in the screenplay and so on. But it's great, you know, I love that jigsaw puzzle aspect to it as well.
And do you know when we might expect to see it on the screen yet, or is that just way ahead in the future?
Way too early.
Okay. And Hafsa, you said you have been writing articles and essays and various things while you're on maternity, but ever thought about, interested in going down the screenwriting route at all?
It's not something I've ever given any thought to. I think
really?
I'm still so early in my writing career. I got one book out. I'd like to get a few other books out, and then maybe let's see. Or if this book got adapted, then maybe I could help in the.
Yeah.
But I don't know. We shall see.
It's not ever been not even thinking of that yet. Let's just get book two out. Is that what you think? Is that where you're at the moment?
While I have this little idea brewing, I want to see what comes of it.
And have you managed to read much whilst you've been on maternity? Because I always like to ask my guests what they've been reading and enjoying recently and to sort of recommend us a few things. Doesn't have to be something that's brand new either, but is there anything that's on your radar at the moment, Hafsa?
Yeah, so I did struggle, I think. I struggled to read during, you know, the first wave of the pandemic, and then I kind of really struggled to read after maternity leave. But the first kind of few months are a lot harder. Once, like Monica said earlier, they start napping and sleeping, you get a hell of a lot done when they're sleeping. So I just start reading again fairly recently. I mean, I've recently read, so on maternity leave, I've read a few books. Most recently, I read The Last One by Fatima Das. She's a French author of Algerian descent.
Okay.
She actually writes under a pseudonym. But her book is about coming out and her identity struggles as a lesbian with a Muslim background and Muslim origin. I've actually found it really, really fascinating because I'd read earlier on in my matinee that I'd read A Dutiful Boy by Mohsen Zaidi, who's also kind of similar kind of, it's a memoir. Interesting, Fatima's book is not, I wouldn't call it a memoir. It's kind of, I think she's described it herself as autofiction. So it's like it's an autobiography, but like with fictional elements. I don't know, you know, like I said, she'd written under a pseudonym because I think she wanted to protect the identities of the people in her community. But I'd never sort of read anything by a North African Muslim, you know, describing their coming out journey. And to be honest, I'd never read anything by a lesbian either. It was like sort of the gay memoirs I'd read. I'd sort of seen Glamroux and things like that. And so I found it really, really moving. Cried a lot because I tend to cry quite a lot when I read if something touches me. But yeah, it's really good. And that's translated. It's translated by Lara Vernga. But I'm also reading The Best Most Awful Job, which is on the theme of motherhood. So that's a collection of essays edited by Catherine May, and it's got, you know, like people like Simon Mayer and Huma Qureshi and Michelle Adams writes about being an adoptive mother. It's just a really, really interesting collection and just sort of showcases the diversity of experiences of motherhood. So that's just something I've slowly been reading. I'm only about 50% of the way through it, but I just read like a chapter of it every night. So yeah, that's pretty much.
Love that title as well.
Yeah, it's very accurate.
And what about you, Monica? Have you found some time to read and got anything that you'd like to sort of share with us that you've enjoyed?
I'm reading Mary McCarthy's The Group at the moment, which I don't know how I've managed to avoid reading it for for all these years. It was published in the 1960s, and I know that it says on the cover something from Candice Bushnell, who was the creator of the Sex and the City, and it said without Mary McCarthy as the group, there would have been no Sex and the City. Oh, yeah. So that sort of gives you a clue. And it's set in the 1930s in New York, and this elite group of young women who are all graduates of this posh college, Vassar College, and there's eight of them, and it sort of goes through their lives almost chapter by chapter. And it's incredibly frank and brutally honest about love, relationships and sex. I mean, there's a great deal of sexual revelation in the book, the awfulness of so many of their sexual encounters through ignorance and through expectation and you know, what a gendered imbalanced society it was. But it's also incredibly funny. She's got a razor sharp wit, Mary McCarthy. So I've nearly finished that. I also read recently At Night All Blood Is Black by David Diop, which won the International Booker 2021, which is about Senegalese soldiers in the trenches of World War One, fighting for the French, and it's about you know, race, masculinity, colonialism, obviously about war, and it's really brutal. I mean, it's a very short book; you can read it in one sitting, but it will never leave you. I mean, it's the savagery of war, the savagery of colonialism. It's really a remarkable book. What else? Natalia Ginzburg. Again, I don't know how I've got to this age in life without reading Natalia Ginzburg, but she's just life-changingly good. And if anyone hasn't read her, I would recommend starting with Family Lexicon, which is her sort of memoir. It's a sort of novelised memoir of growing up in Italy and then fascist Italy under Mussolini in a family that was half Jewish. And it's so unsparing of herself, and it's so unsentimental and so generous and wise and compassionate that you know, really, you have to read it.
Wow.
I'm now quite worried about Book Off, because you've already pitched this one pretty well.
She's really warming up now, I have to say. She's really warming up for this.
Oh, yeah. That's it. Getting in the swing.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Oh, well, I loved all of those recommendations. Thank you so much. And as you so brilliantly set up, Hafsa, it is now time for the book off. This is where each of you is going to get 3 minutes uninterrupted on the clock to tell us about a book you love that you think we should all read. And I'm always very careful not to say to any of my guests that it has to be their favourite book, because I just think, I don't know if I could choose a favourite book, you know? I it would change every week for me. So I don't put that pressure on. It's just a book you love, you think we should all read. It can be anything in terms of genre. It can be old, it can be new. So I'm excited to see what you're putting up. Before we get to that, we've got to decide who goes first, who goes second. So, Monica, would you like to step up to the plate first, or are you going to see what Hafsa's got?
I don't mind. I could go first, but I have a question.
Yes.
What happens if I haven't... I've put down some notes, but I haven't timed it. If I break the 3-second barrier, will I be penalised?
So, if you're still, you don't have to use 3 minutes, Monica. So it may be that you bring it in under the 3 minutes. But if you're still talking at the 3 minute mark, you're either going to be rung out by the school bell or honked out by the bicycle hall.
I've got to set a timer. I mean, you know, how will I know?
Well, this is it. I mean, you could keep a timer on in the background. Some people do. Some people choose to. And would you like the school bell or the bicycle horn at your 3 minutes?
Definitely the horn.
You're getting that right. Yeah, okay, that means hilarious. You've got the bell, Monica. And I will try to be... I will try to be polite and not interrupt you, but...
I'm so tense.
So, just before we start the 3 minutes, tell us the book you're putting forward, Monica.
It's A House for Mr. Biswas by V.S. Naipaul.
Fantastic. All right. 3 minutes on the clock, uninterrupted. It's over to you to tell us about A House for Mr. Biswas.
So, it was published in 1961, and it's set in Trinidad, where V.S. Naipaul grew up. The protagonist is inspired by Naipaul's father. So Mr. Biswas is born a Brahmin, an upper caste person, but he's born into poverty and he's the son of a labourer. And moreover, according to the astrologer's charts, he's born in the wrong way, in inverted commas. So we know that he's doomed to struggle all his life with what seems like quite a modest ambition to have a house of his own. And we know from the very beginning that he achieves this, because the prologue, he has a house in Port of Spain with a slumber king bed, and he reflects on how terrible it would have been, quote, to have lived without even attempting to lay claim to one's portion of the earth, to have lived and died as one had been born, unnecessary and unaccommodated. And then we begin these epic struggles which have brought him to the Port of Spain. So from infancy, he's forced to live as a guest in one crowded, inhospitable house after another. After his father dies, his family moves in with his mother's sister. He's humiliated, he's beaten. And then he goes off to work for the more privileged Tulsi family, who are also Brahmins, and they bully him into marrying their daughter. And it's a long, unhappy marriage full of quarrels and fights. And he's still going off to try and get a house of his own and constantly having to return to this Tulsi household, who are, he views as his enemies. And he daydreams about becoming a writer. He does manage to become a journalist for a tabloid paper called The Sentinel. And he comes home from work and he gets into his slumber king bed to read Marcus Aurelius and other classics. And that combination of slumber king bed and Aurelius is sort of a distillation of the tone of this novel, because it's mock heroic. It's a funny book, and unlike other comic novels, it gets funnier the more times you read it, because the comedy is the comedy of human striving and folly and failing and delusion and determination and the ability to embrace it all with compassion So it's a masterpiece of literature of the 20th century. It's complex, profound, majestic, epic, intimate, and flawless.
Wow. You had 3 seconds to spare as well, but you knew that, didn't you? You put a little timer on. Fantastic. Well done. Thank you so much. Have a break. Have a breather. We'll come back and talk about that in just a moment. But it's over to you now, Hafsa. I'm going to put 3 minutes back on the clock. And just before we start, tell us the book that you're putting forward, please.
So my book is called Feed by M.T. Anderson.
Fantastic. It's 3 minutes on the clock, uninterrupted. Over to you to tell us about Feed.
So I actually didn't ever choose to buy this book or read it, which is odd that I'm putting it forward for the book off. But it's basically cyberpunk subgenre, which is like, you know, dystopian worlds and futures with like cyborgs and low life society and stuff. It's not really the kind of stuff that I read, although I do like to watch the films. I love Blade Runner. But anyway, I actually won this book. So I entered a competition when I was like much younger, and I won a bunch of uncorrected book proofs. And this was one of them. And so, you know, it's young adult fiction, but I just read it and my mind was blown. And it's just stayed with me ever since. I just recommended it to everyone at the time. I still recommend it to people today. And I just feel like it's become more and more relevant as time's gone on. So it's set in a world where people have this super advanced form of the internet implanted into their brains, ostensibly when they're sort of like infants. And this internet connection allows people to chat wordlessly. It allows, you know, to buy things. It's basically just having your mobile phone inside your brain. And the story opens with the young protagonist, who's a young man called Titus, and his friends going on holiday to the moon. And on the moon, Titus meets Violet, who is, as he thinks, the most beautiful woman he's ever seen in the world and in the moon. And Violet's a bit strange, right? She's a bit weird. And you kind of later discover that Violet did not get the feed when she was a baby, unlike most people. She got the feed when she was 7 years old. And, you know, her dad is quite eccentric and he lives in a house that's like still full of real books and things like that. Shock, horror. So they're not on the same level as everybody else. They don't subscribe to the kind of dominance of the feed in the way that the vast majority of society seems to. Now, I don't want to like sort of give away too much of the story. I don't want to give away any spoilers because obviously the objective is to get you to want to read this. But at its heart, at its core, it's a love story. And it's a love story about the relationship between Titus and Violet. And I think the reason that it really stayed with me and compared to sort of the books, the love stories that I was reading at the time, is that this love story is kind of more about the absence of morality and the kind of apathy in the way in which Titus kind of expresses himself towards Violet in the relationship. And you're obviously invited to think as the reader that that's as a result of the feed. But anyway, it's a story that's way more than just a story about love. It's about consumerism and capitalism and rapidly developing technological advancements and the ways in which these things can pose a danger to and threaten not just sort of the morality and upkeep of society, but its very existence. You know, it's about change and it's about progression and versus traditionalism. When I read this proof, I was 11 years old. We didn't have mobile phones. We didn't even have broadband. And when I think, oh no, I quite wanted to be honked out, to be fair. I didn't set a timer.
You set it up so that you were still talking. I know it. You just wanted that bicycle horn.
Oh, I had more to say. I had so much more to say. It's just brilliant. It's so relevant. It's so, so relevant.
Amazing. Wow, what a wonderful pitch as well. Thank you so much. And both of these books just sound fabulous. House for Mr. Biswas, Monica, is a book that I know of through doing some work with the Booker Prize. And I absolutely loved your pitch. I have never read it. It's a book that comes up again and again as this sort of like, what, you know, get on with it, mate. But, you know, like you were saying a bit earlier, oh, I finally got round to reading X and Y and I can't believe that I've never, you know, it's the same for this one because this is probably the fourth or fifth time that someone has told me about it. And you just set it up so wonderfully. And that sort of last line of your pitch saying it's just a masterpiece of literature. I mean, how can you not want to read this book after hearing about that? And I also think a book that gets funnier the more times that you read it is a rare thing, don't you?
I do, because there is a sort of farce aspect to it. There is a hectic, antic, comedic strain to it, but the comedy just goes a lot deeper than that. And the more that you understand of life, you know, the older you get, the funnier this book gets, because you understand exactly his predicament, which is that we're sort of all we're full of self-delusions, we're full of flaws, we're full of petty thoughts that we wish that we weren't having, we're full of grandeur and self-loathing and self-doubt alongside, you know, the good aspects of ourselves. And that's what is funny. It's a very human comedy. And it's done with tenderness, and it's done with compassion, and it's also within a much wider, I mean, it's a brilliant book in microcosm, but also at a macro scale, it can be read as a kind of situated within colonialist history, as Trinidad being on the cusp of being post-colonial. Mm. So what traditions are we going to shake off from the colonialist past? What customs and what power structures are we going to overturn? So Biswas, he's trying to disentangle himself from family and customs and traditions and entanglements of the old order. You know, there's a lot about religion in there as well, and the caste system and racism and so on. It's a book that you can read on so many levels, and it's also very rooted in place. I mean, Naipaul clearly has a great love for the beauty of the country, for all the brutal poverty that exists there. His love of the landscape is unparalleled in his beautiful, longing, you know, evocative descriptions.
Yeah, right. Wow. I just think it sounds amazing. You've really made me want to go and read it. I've had it on the ever-growing list of, like, come on, Joe, you've got to get around to it. And you've really, really pushed that to the top of the list after talking about it. And I have to say, Hafsa, I don't know of Feed or of M.T. Anderson. And what I loved about your pitch was the fact that this book, you know, it could have so easily not been on your radar, and you might never have read it, but you won this competition, and then that, and it stuck with you this whole time. And I love a book like that, that blows your mind, stays with you when you're a bit younger, and then just, you know, you want to tell everyone about it, and you sort of push it on to everyone. It just sounds amazing and unbelievably contemporary, really.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know if this is true, but it's certainly true of me. I tend to sort of stick to certain genres of books. Like, I don't really veer out of my lane too much when it comes, you know, there's certain types of genre that I like to read. I like to read a bit of romance. I like to read stuff about, like, I like the odd historical fiction. I like books which involve, like, you know, contemporary exposition of, like, race and, like, you know, colonialism and things like that. So I stick to very, like, kind of set categories. I'll read things that are, you know, popular at the time. Like, you know, I'll read things that have been on the Booker list or, you know, just to sort of keep up to date with what's going on. But I don't tend to do things like cyberpunk subgenre or anything like that. I don't read fantasy, you know, like sort of proper fantasy, which my mum loves. So half her library was excluded to me anyway. but yeah, so that's why I had to pick this book, because it's something that wasn't typically on my radar. I would have never have picked it up. And I just loved it. I mean, to be fair, it should have made me read more cyberpunk. I've never read any other cyberpunk.
You do. So you don't need to now. Because it's like it's almost like you've read this one and that's it. You wouldn't want, you peaked. But isn't it amazing that I mean, when do you think this book was written? When are we talking?
So it was 2002. It was published in 2002. Okay, so because I got an uncorrected proof, I'm pretty sure it was around
yeah. So it's 20 years old.
Yeah, exactly.
And
yeah.
It's talking about having the internet in our brains. You know,
Elon Musk is doing it.
Yeah, I mean, and here we are thinking, God, yeah, this is, and so many people, especially younger generations, are so addicted to their phone, you know, literally head down. We don't do anything without our phone. Some people can't seem to think without their phone. It's like, wow, it really, I mean, they were onto something.
Yeah, it's honestly so reflective, I think, of kind of the way that society could potentially be heading, and it's kind of a warning to you know, the future. But
yeah. Wow. Well, I loved both of those pictures, and honestly, Monica, the amount of times I've said I've got to read A House for Mr. Biswas, I'm going to, I promise. Thank you to your pitch. Thanks to your pitch. And I absolutely loved yours, Hafsa, because it just feels so relevant, and like you obviously are so passionate about this book, and it's I love a YA book as well, because I think YA is such a hard category to get people to read because they believe that it's young adult, it's children's. And actually, I think YA gets a bit of a bad rep being categorized in that way, because actually I just think it means, you know, oh, it's not really for children.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, that's it. And so I'm always a massive champion for YA, because I think it should be more widely read by all adults as well as teenagers. Do you know? So I'm gonna choose the feed. Actually, I'm gonna go with the feed, Hafsa. I think you've just swayed it for me with all. It's there was something about that passion there, and I really want to read this book as well.
Excellent, thank you.
Well, okay.
But I promise, once I've read House for Mr. Biswas, I will let you know so that I can finally put that one to bed and tick it off the blooming list, which has been on. It's just been on there for so long. Thank you both for those wonderful pictures. Really, really enjoyed them. And Love Marriage by Monica Ali is out now. It's published by Virago. And We Are All Birds of Uganda by Hafsa Zayan is also out now, published by Murky Books. And what a joy it's been to spend this time in your company. Thank you both for joining us. Thanks for your recommendations. And well, we look forward to the TV adaptation, Monica, whenever that may be. And Hafsa, we look forward to book two, whenever and whatever that may be. Thank you both so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.